Hey, what's up, everyone? This is Radio Free Nintendo, episode 163. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me today, James Jones.
Hello.
John Lindemann.
Ahoy, ahoy.
No.
Son of a bitch.
And Greg Leahy.
Do I have to do rap now?
Yeah.
Yes. All episode.
Woo, okay. So we're so happy to be in your ears today or tonight or this morning or yesterday or tomorrow.
Up in your ear holes.
Man, we are in your cranium right now. Mm-hmm. We are in your brain and you can't get us out. It's too late. And we're going to talk about Nintendo.
For once. It is actually noteworthy to say we're going to talk about Nintendo.
Yes, we usually do. But later in the show, we're actually going to have a very special segment with Jeff Callis from Penny Arcade, formerly of Nintendo of America, to talk about Geist, a game that he was intimately familiar with. And we'll talk about some Penny Arcade Expo stuff, too, which I think will be pretty interesting to a lot of our listeners. And after that, we'll have listener mail, as usual. But for now, we got us some new business. And I believe Greg is up first.
Yep, so I'm back to Japanese virtual consoling.
Awesome. Already tired of the PS3.
Oh, yeah, it's balls, isn't it? It's HD shit. Yeah, so they didn't have any games this week because it's some sort of weird holiday over there. Something like Citizens Holiday. I don't know what it is. I think they just made it up or something. But last week they brought out Gambare Goemon 3. So, yes, the third in the Super Famicom line of Goemon games. Although they do go back further than that in Japan. They were actually on the Famicom as well.
Ooh.
I think they were quite different. They were a lot more overhead and sort of vaguely Zelda-ish, but kind of like a brawler as well, but no platforming. But with this one, it's more like the first one, which came over as to the West as The Legend of the Mystical Ninja, in terms of it's kind of half and half, where you've got these overhead kind of town sequences mixed with the side-scrolling stages.
Well, this is a late Super Famicom game, right?
Yeah, this is 94, so it's getting there, although there was a fourth one, which a lot of people think is the best of them all, so hopefully they will get to that eventually. Because I've been enjoying this one so far, because it's quite different from the second one, which I played, because that was pretty much like Super Mario World, sort of the map where you move between levels, pretty much the same. It had alternate exits pretty similarly. I mean, it was very much patterned on that. Whereas this is more sort of genre blending again. And the overhead sequences now have kind of a bit Zelda-ish, really. You sort of go around and go to towns and like play little mini games and do stuff to help you progress. And obviously it's much lighter than Zelda. And instead of dungeons, really, you get these 2D side-scrolling bits, which are in themselves different from the side-scrolling action in the previous game that I played, because they are quite explorative. You have like a map for each level. You'll often like be backtracking and stuff, like you'll activating switches, or you even like blow up cracks in the wall to find secret stuff. So even in that sense, there's some Zelda comparisons to be made. So it's quite interesting in that sense.
That sounds a lot more sophisticated than the side-scrolling stuff in the first Gambare Goemon, which was Legend of the Mystical Ninja.
Yeah, and like it's quite different from the second one, which was unsophisticated, but it was all out action. I mean, that's what it was, whereas this is kind of puzzly and explorative. And the other thing is that you had multiple characters that you could play as in the second game, but with this now, you could just switch on the fly during gameplay, and they have different abilities. And so there's four characters. It's very much like the Super Mario Bros. 2 USA kind of playbook of having four characters, in terms of you've got the ones that's got the big jump or that's really fast or all that kind of thing. But other than that, they've all got individual items, so you'll have to earn the guy's bonds to do stuff in levels. Or you've got the female character can become a mermaid to navigate water levels and stuff like that. So it's quite sophisticated. It's quite different from the second one, so I've been really enjoying that.
Are you having any trouble getting through it with Japanese?
Yeah, well, the overhead sequences are really text heavy. There is no chance of this ever coming as an import game, I don't think, but there are facts for it, so I'm just sort of fumbling my way through that, and then you get to the side-scrolling levels, and then that's fine. You could just work all of that out for yourself. So certainly not as daunting as working my way through Chibi Robo, on import. I could do anything in that regard there. But it's all there, the kind of wackiness of Go On. Like the plot, from what I could gather, is something about going into the future to fight against a futuristic nun that looks exactly like his sidekick. It's so weird. It's so weird. And like, there's like a canned laughter track in this. For some reason.
That's very Goemon. Yeah, they did that in the 64 game too.
And you get the impact giant robot boss battles are back, and there's just like some sequences that are pretty funny and pretty inventive. Like all of a sudden in one part you've got three of the characters are all in little mechs and they're getting chased by a sort of bigger mech, and you have to select which one to dodge as the giant thing shoots at them and stuff in a mode 7 kind of sequence. So it does kind of change things up quite frequently. So not nearly as formulaic as a lot of the games of that era when you go back at it and think about it. So really cool game, and very nice to have a chance to play that. And just for a sort of bit of trivia here, I think in about 4 weeks' time, the Japanese Virtual Console will hit number 500.
Wow.
Oh, so they're keeping it close.
Yeah, what are we at now?
About 320, I think,
oh,
in America.
God, that's brutal.
I mean, I wonder whether they're going to have something special for that. I mean, there hasn't been a lot of Nintendo stuff in Japan. Like, a lot of it has been third parties like Konami or the arcade stuff, mostly. Mm. But I just wonder if there's still some big guns to pull out, like Yoshi's Island or something, but
yeah,
I'll be interested. I think we'll get the list for next month in a couple of days, so we'll be able to find out quite soon what that 500th game would be, unless they're going to keep it secret.
Woo!
Okay, so John, on a completely different page, you could go from Japanese virtual console stuff to what, PC MMORPGs.
Yeah, this Great. Week, the big release this week was Ion, which is made by NCSoft, who does Guild Wars and a whole bunch of, kind of long-standing MMOs. It's a Korean game, so it's really kind of heavily Asian-influenced. The characters, I wouldn't say it's not anime-influenced. It more looks like Tekken or Final Fantasy, has that kind of art style to it. But yeah, like kind of in the background, I've always been playing Warhammer Online, and basically I'm going to cancel that. And the reason why I'm going to cancel that is because, and I remember Johnny's been kind of a critic of MMORPGs generally. Why would you ever pay $15 a month for, for something like that? It's kind of ongoing, which is valid.
I think you're mischaracterizing me a little bit. I mean, I just always said I didn't want to do them.
Yeah.
It's not worth it to me, and plus I feel like if I started playing one of those, it would probably be really addicting, and it might turn into the only game I play.
Mm-hmm.
And there are too many other games that I'm interested in, so I wouldn't want to have my time and money monopolized like that.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, my point with that is that the reason why I'm dumping Warhammer is not because I don't like the game, is because of content. I mean, one of the things, essentially with any MMO, you're basically subscribing to a service, right? So, and you're kind of, there's kind of like the tacit agreement that you're going to keep getting content for it.
Someone's not been living up to their end of the bargain, is that what you're telling me?
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, I looked around and, Warhammer's been out for a year now, and there's really, doesn't look like there's any new areas on the horizon. They haven't announced anything like that. Meanwhile, other MMOs like Lord of the Rings Online they have an expanded area coming at the end of this year. World of Warcraft has like Cataclysm or whatever. In the time that Warhammer's been out, there's been these major expanded areas to these other MMOs, and I'm like, come on, there's really nothing there. You level your character all the way up, and then you don't have anything else to do with it. So I'm dumping that, and I'm getting into Ion, which seems pretty cool, but the problem with it is that right now the queue times for the servers are ridiculous because there's so many people trying to get on. You sit there, and literally, if you want to get on at prime time, like right now, like 9 o'clock Eastern, you have to sit there and wait for 2 hours to get on a server.
Wait. And you're paying for this?
Correct.
You're paying for the privilege of playing on their servers, and they're making you wait 2 hours.
That's the way
but
it goes right now.
This isn't unheard of. Back when World of Warcraft came out, mm-hmm. it was like 4 hours. I mean, it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
Wow. I hope it's worth it when you get in.
Yeah, I mean, it will be. I mean, the thing is, they kind of walk that line, right? Because they start off with a small amount of servers. What they don't want is a whole bunch of servers. This was one of the things that Warhammer ran into, was they started off with 55 servers in the U.S., they're now at 7 because
over capacity. Yeah.
That's the thing. What happened was they had all these servers to start out with. People left the game. never came back. And so you had servers with nobody on them. And so what they had to do, then there was the whole thing of, you know, they had to force people to transfer over to other servers and all that kind of crap. So basically NCSoft is kind of doing it the smart way in that they're letting the game kind of grow to demand rather than trying to anticipate some massive demand and then shrinking it.
I mean, that works, but you have to be ready to, you know, grow to demand immediately versus what they've been doing, which is not.
Well, they've already added one server, I think, this week. So they're bringing them on, but, you know, they're doing it slowly. So, but yeah, you know, once I get to play it, it should be pretty cool.
Once I get to play it, it should be pretty cool.
That is vintage. How many of the games that you own could you say that about, John, by the way?
Yeah, John, you already had a head start on this. I mean, you had plenty of games you weren't playing for free. I mean, why would you pay to not play a game when you had plenty of opportunities to repeat
that? I
want
to save John from the ribbing
here
a little
bit. Can't be done.
The thing is, I haven't played it. I'm not sitting there staring for 2 hours at a screen.
Right. Obviously.
And at the same time, I don't look at it like, oh my God, I'm spending 2 cents, 0.003% of a cent for every minute I'm not playing this game. I don't look at it like that.
Well, did you at least get the first month free on your subscription?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so that gives them, that sort of gives the developers a trial period to get their shit straightened out, right, in terms of servers and
The thing is, you don't want your server to be empty. So if there are queues, even though it blows, that is actually a good sign because it means that other people are playing on that server. That is the whole point
playing one of those games. This is all an elaborate setup. Nobody's playing on those servers. It's just denying connections.
So this segues into really a big reason why I haven't played any MMOs yet.
Yeah.
And maybe this is why – maybe I've said something to this effect before and it's why you think I'm a hater on them or whatever, but – to me, a massively multiplayer online game, if you're paying to have a persistent world and everybody is sort of playing together and every character that you see in the world is a player, to me, first off, that means everybody should be on one single gigantic server. And maybe the technologies, maybe it's not possible to do that right now.
Some games do. EVE Online does that.
Okay. Yeah, but that's not, you know, massive title.
Yeah, it is.
Well, maybe it just depends on your definition. But to me, this business of, oh, I'm on a different server than my friend. So, I mean, I actually did a trial of EverQuest a long, long, long time ago with Evan Birchfield.
Yeah.
And oh, God, what was that like?
We had to go, well, I mean, I only played it for like an hour. I thought it was the most boring shit ever. And the thing is, you know, I'm killing rats, and Evan's trying to find me, but he's on a different server, so he's trying to transfer over to my server, and then he's trying to, like, get to the part of the world where I'm at, and he can't see me because of some sync issue. It's like, you know, isn't the point that you're supposed to be able to play online with your friends? I mean, I guess you can make friends within the game who are already near you, but it would be nice if I could go in there and say, follow Evan. And wherever he is, it would take me there so he can show me around. As it is, you kind of rely on the generosity of strangers to kind of walk you through the early parts of the game and explain things.
Well, I mean, the whole idea is to join a server where your friends are.
Okay. Maybe have wildly disparate sets of friends who are playing this game and they're on different servers, and how am I supposed to choose? Like, I shouldn't have to make that choice. That's what I'm saying. So, the other part is, to me, these games really aren't, most of them are not really very persistent at all. You know, like, the things that you do in the world don't really have a lasting effect. Most of the characters, like, for instance, in WoW, there are tons of characters that aren't being played by a real person. They just sit there. Mm-hmm. And most of the things that you do in a game like WoW, especially, and I think EverQuest was like this as well, are instanced, which means that you kind of have the hub world where everybody's hanging out massively, you know, hundreds and thousands of people. But when you get ready to actually go play the game, you talk to some non-player character to start a quest, and then you run off with a group of 20 people, and you go into some cave that exists completely separately from everything else that's going on in the game.
Yeah.
So I have issues with that. Like, I feel like if I'm paying for this world to be upkept and maintained and evolved over time and new content being added and, you know, I'm on this server with all these other people, I want to be playing with all of those other people. And you know, there's some major game design challenges in doing that, but to me, that is the, on the face of when you tell someone a massively multiplayer RPG, and I think of what an RPG is like, and I think of massive as being, you know, at least hundreds of people, to me, that ideal of what you would expect from that description really hasn't been done yet, and EVE Online's probably the the closest thing.
Yeah.
And it's the most tempting to me, except then you hear all these horror stories about how ridiculously hard it is and how it takes years and years and years to build up. But, mm-hmm. I mean, at least they've got principles, you know, on EVE Online. Like, everything I hear about that game makes me respect it a lot.
Yeah.
And I think it's just, at this point, it's way too late for me to jump into it.
Well, but that's the thing is, that's the reason why, you know, I'm not playing World of Warcraft. I do play Lord of the Rings Online, but, you know, there's, like, all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's all PvE, like player versus environment, which means that it's mm-hmm. you grouping with your friends fighting NPCs, like computer monsters, right? Mm-hmm. That's really not my bag. I find that pretty boring. So that's why, like, with Warhammer, I mean, you actually do play other players. And, you know, you have to – there's coordination involved. There's strategy involved. This group mm-hmm. goes over here to capture this objective. This group goes over here. It's almost – it's actually more like – I've heard it described as more like Team Fortress, which is probably a more apt description rather than just the typical World of Warcraft MMORPG. And so that's why Ion is kind of like – it seems like a more polished version of Warhammer where you level up your character to level 25 or 30 or something like that. And then at that point, you can go into a player versus player zone. That's the thing. I find MMORPGs without that player versus player element very, very boring. I really can't play them very long.
We're way over our our yearly ration of MMO talk on this podcast.
Yep.
So
for life.
So I have been playing mostly PS3 the past week. I wrapped up a couple other things. Well, I've played a lot of Geist, but other than that, I haven't had time to play any big console games very much. So I did download a couple things on PS3, and the one that I really, really, really want to talk up is Flower. It is a $10 downloadable game, and it just came out, I don't know, really early this year, I think. And Flower is, it's kind of hard to explain. It is kind of, it's a flying game. You control this gust of wind, and the object is to fly through these beautiful prairies and fields of grass, and then later on the environments get sort of different towards the end of the game. But the idea is that you fly through these fields and you fly past flower buds that aren't blossomed yet, and as you pass by them, they blossom, and you pick up a petal off of them, and it's added to the trail that's blowing in the wind behind your focal point. So as you play through a stage of this, you gather more and more and more flower petals, and it's a very interesting visual effect, and you control everything with the motion control of the 6-axis or the DualShock 3 on the PS3. So, I mean, it's interesting because this is probably the most I've used motion control in a game in quite a while. I mean, the game is so heavily leveraged on motion control, and it works so well that you have to think of this game being on Wii, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I've played anything on Wii that really feels this good. Probably the closest thing might be the air activity, the flying activities in Wii Sports Resort, which I haven't really mm-hmm. played yet, because I haven't picked up Resort yet, although I plan to. So that's probably the closest thing, but Flower is very, very organic. There is nothing on the screen. There's no interface at all. You push one button to fly forward, and it can be any button. You just hold it down, and you steer entirely with motion control, and it feels really good. And the game really doesn't explain anything to you. So you jump into it, and you just kind of experience it and absorb it.
Yeah, I guess that's, I mean, it's, from everything I've heard about it, it's one of these, you know, kind of audio-visual experience kind of things, really, as much as it is a game.
It is very much, but at the same time, you do play it. It may be a casual game. I'm not even sure if I would describe it that way, because
yeah,
I think the
designer actually, I think he described it as interactive poetry, if I remember correctly.
That's just pretentious. I mean, Flower, like, some people might actually think that the game itself is pretentious. I could see that. It definitely has lofty ambitions. Towards the end of the game, you can tell it's trying to send certain messages. It's trying to tell a story in a very subtle, indirect way. It's trying to evoke emotions in you, and I respect all of that as long as that's not all it does. Mm-hmm. And on top of all of those, you know, very lofty type things, Flower is also very, very beautiful. I mean, eye-catching as hell, really captivating in kind of a just like a hypnotic way. You just can't take your eyes off of it. I can't wait to invite my friends over of all different, you know, gaming
persuasions,
aptitude. Yeah. I can't wait to invite people over here and just show it to them and put it in their hands and see what they think. Because
it's interesting because obviously, like you said, the controls are very simple, you know, intuitive with the motion controls. You only press one button or whatever, you know, it's pretty simple. I remember, was it when John Davison was doing something about this when it came out on his podcast, the What They Play podcast, that he recorded a segment where he put it in his wife's hands and just saw how she reacted to it, who's not really a game, and she was kind of befuddled by it. It was not as immediate as probably the developers would have hoped, even though they kind of got rid of a lot of the staple gaming stuff, like the HUD and you know, all that kind of stuff. So
I don't necessarily think that the studio was going after something that was really easy. And
well, there's a difference between accessibility and ease.
Exactly, because the game actually, there is skill involved in steering it. There are some really gamey bits, like if you're really, really thorough with picking up all the flowers, which certainly is not required, but if you're really thorough, you might find a kind of a little secret place with a special green flower that's kind of a collectible, you know, and it has trophies. I mean, there is a way to play the game better as opposed to playing it worse, you know. So I mean, there is skill involved.
I mean, a lot of very accessible games or so-called casual games played by, you know, what you might consider casual players will actually play that particular game in what we might call a very hardcore way. You know, they might not play anything else, but they might be like ridiculously good at Peggle or something. You definitely need that depth there, whatever audience you're going for.
Well, yeah, and that's kind of why I hesitate to call Flower a casual game, because it's not like Peggle at all. It's not like Minesweeper. It's not like Tower Defense or anything like that.
Peggle is hardcore. I don't want to hear it.
Peggle-core.
Peggle-core. Nice. Yeah, Flower is it is more of an artistic experience, but like I said, at the same time, it is a game. It feels like a game, and it hits your brain in the way that a really good video game does. Well, that's not how I feel games, but I'm not surprised to hear that that's how you feel games, James.
It's just got a lot of Peter Gabriel on his mind, I don't know.
I was just trying to think, like, how do I even describe this, or how do I talk about it? And the word that comes to mind is glorious. I mean, playing through it, my eyes get wide, and my breath stops for a second, you know, as I take things in. I mean,
it's very leveraged on the visuals, you think?
It is, and the visuals aren't super technical or anything. They're just
the
extremely well put together. Yeah, but it's not just the visuals. It's the way everything fits together. It's the feeling that you get as you fly through this and as you accomplish things, as you see the world transform. And the cool thing about the game is that as you pick up all these flower petals and you're flying around, it sounds really hippie, I know, but as you do all of this, the world is changing around you in very much the same way that happens in Da Blob, you know, the Wii game. Yeah. And I was just thinking, man, I bet the guys who made Da Blob, I bet when they played Flower, they were just like, oh, we just got owned, because Flower takes a very similar concept, but it does it in a much more abstract, really a more interesting way, and the game just plays so much better than Da Blob. It's a very graceful game. It doesn't have any kind of, you know, frustration or any kind of thing to get in the way of you experiencing it.
Well, I take it it's not drawn out. I mean, in terms of a play session, it would not be incumbent on you to play for as long.
Exactly. Yeah, you can beat the whole thing in probably an hour and a half, 2 hours. But
the sort of the evolution of the world as you sort of interact with it, I assume, is far more subtle than just it gets colored in.
Well, I mean, to some extent, things do get colored in, very much in the way of Da Blob. But as they get colored in, they also shift and move and become more upright or more natural,
organic environments rather than just a bunch of blocks.
Right. It's handled in a much more, I don't know if I'd say serious, but a much more like...
elegant?
Yes. Very, very, very elegant. Anyway, I feel like I'm just kind of blabbering about this because I just finished playing it right before we started recording. It's very fresh on my mind, and it was a pretty spectacular experience. No, I didn't cry. But there was a little hesitation to buy it because there's no demo of it. And, you know, even though it's only $10, which is not bad, but it's, you know, I hesitate all the time on games that are 1,000 Wii points.
Also, it's a kind of a weird, like, it's kind of a weird concept to say, yeah, I like that.
To be affirmative about without trying it.
Well, yeah, because it's, I mean, most games, it's like, okay, I like this genre. I've heard this game is good for that genre.
Yeah, and Flower is not like anything else. But I was actually listening last week to G4's Feedback podcast, which I didn't even know existed until recently. Our friend Billy Berghammer hosts that. He didn't even tell me about it, so now I'm trying to catch up on it a little bit. But it's very new. It's only a couple of months old. But Andrew Pfister was on there, you know, formerly of 1UP and 1UP Yours, and Skip said that Flower is his game of the year. And I thought, wow, really? I mean, a $10 download game for PS3 is your game of the year so far, at least. And that kind of pushed me over. That made me really curious to see, like, so, I mean, that told me that, well, obviously it's not a glorified screensaver, you know, or some weird aerial aquarium or something like that. I mean, obviously he feels like it's a game. It's something to be experienced. So that's why I downloaded it. I'm really, really glad I did. The other thing I won't talk about nearly as much, but I've also been playing Pixel Junk Eden, and I know John has this, right?
Yeah.
It's funny because it's another game about flowers, but it really couldn't be more different from Flower because it's a straight-up platformer. I mean, it's not like any other platformer I've ever played. It's certainly unique, but at the same time, it's very much rooted in the conventions of that genre. And, you know, in some cases, it's subverting some of those conventions. But it is about jumping around, getting up to a high place, using the platforms that
and
are there.
Falling all the way back down.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of that. It's very demanding skill-wise once you get an hour into it.
Yeah.
You'll start to hit stuff where you're like, man, that's going to be hard to get to. I'm going to have to kind of go around and really think about it.
Yeah, it becomes quite tactical. You're like, okay, if I miss this, I'm screwed. Because I'm going to have to get all the way back up here.
That's not tactical. That's just fatalistic.
it's tough. It reminds me of like an old school kind of 8-bit platformer where like the first Metroid, kind of. It has the same kind of difficulty curve where if you miss something, you're like you're going all the way back down and it'll take you 5 minutes to backtrack.
There is a strange kind of retro feel to it, even though it's very new age kind of, you know, presentation. It looks like a really nice flash game with bright neon colors and weird techno kind of groove trance music going on and stuff like that. But I mean, it plays pretty old school. It's really interesting and having some familiarity with Q Games and the stuff they made in the past. It really made me want to check it out, and I'm glad I did. I did pick up, you know, at GameStop they dropped the price of Little King Story to $30. And it might have been Luke Belichki who told me that, but I went and picked it up when I got Guys. So I got that for $30, and I haven't had time to put it in yet. So maybe next week I'll have a Wii game to talk about, because I really do want to get into that. And James, wrap up new business, please.
Yeah, so I went ahead and I got the second Layton title, since I figured, all right, I've waited long enough that the two games won't...
a whole 2 days?
There was about a week and a half. There was concern that the games would blend together in my head, too, if I played them too close together. So I gave them a tangible split punctuated by a different title.
People go through this with Harry Potter all the time.
Sure, I'll take your word for it.
Well, you're really holding down the DS fort for the podcast.
I am. It's sad. I've got like this large stack of DS games on my desk, yes.
Yeah. I want to pick some up.
It's funny because I think I was the person who was most neglecting the DS, excepting John, who doesn't play Nintendo games, for like most of the podcast's history since we've been on it. Yeah. But
oh man, like the first 3 or 4 months of this year, I was blowing up on DS.
Yeah, DS is great.
It's very busy.
But let's see, I got it today, and I've put in about 2 hours today. So I haven't seen any like really difficult challenges yet. I mean, I like that the game is now more, not linear, but it's easier to navigate around because you're on a train. Not like you're navigating some windy-ass town that looks like it's from a French countryside. You know, there's only two directions you can go in. And it does make it easier to go from place to place, but it does take out a little bit of the exploration element, I guess. There's not too much to surprise you in a train. One train car looks like the next one. But I'm kind of glad they've carried over a lot of the characters from the first game, because the game actually had... a good cast to support it.
So is that how they're explaining the fact that all these people are giving you puzzles?
No.
That they're the same characters?
No, no, they're not. They're not those things.
Oh, okay.
Now I don't think there's any story conceit. They're just like, yep, everybody gives you puzzles.
Oh, okay.
Like the train's mechanic, who, you know, is a position that often is filled by puzzle masters that are out of work. Basically tells you that I'm the train's mechanic, but this train is top of the line. It runs smooth as butter, so I use my free time to come up with puzzles. Here's a puzzle. That's the whole conversation. That's it.
Makes sense. Yep.
And then you proceed to solve the puzzle, and then he goes, well, if I gotta kill all this time, why'd you have to go solve the puzzle so fast? This is
you're just too good
of our conversation. But there's basically no story conceit at this point. It's like, yes, you solve puzzle.
Well, you never know. You would have thought that until the last moment of the previous one. They might have something.
I mean, if this like we said, if this happens again, it's time to start dissecting yourself.
Professor Layton's Existential Crisis.
That's the third title.
Professor Layton and the Afterlife.
It's very odd, though, in retrospect, because they've actually made more of a big deal about what Layton actually is, which is a professor of archaeology.
Hmm. Right, yeah, it was pretty loosely defined what he was a professor of.
Why exactly does he investigate missing people, crimes, and other mysteries while solving puzzles if he is a professor of archaeology?
It's kind of like Samus is supposedly a bounty hunter.
Doesn't he have a dig site to visit or something?
Or
a class to teach? Why is he leading around a 12-year-old boy?
Or a whip to crack?
he just walks around with a 12-year-old boy all day.
Or a refrigerator to climb into?
Lead lined.
Yeah.
But it's early in the game, so it's hard to judge, you know, the difficulty of the puzzles and things. So obviously they've been pretty easy so far. I do like that they've continued to put in the whole concept of you collect these different items to achieve objectives. In the first game, there was a painting that you got scraps of and you had to put together like a jigsaw puzzle. And the second one was this robot you got parts for and it sniffed out things for you. In this game, you get a fat hamster. You have to make lose weight by getting toys from it to run from one to another.
Oh, I thought you were saying you find pieces of a fat hamster.
No, you actually get a fat hamster.
Vaguely disturbing.
It is. You are awarded a fat hamster very early in the game that you get to name. So mine is named Toby, and I'm now trying to make Toby lose weight. And the other one is pieces of what appears to be a camera that you have to reassemble inside of the camera. I'm not quite sure what the appeal of these things are, but it's interesting nonetheless, I guess.
And Luke, any awesome new lines for Luke?
Oh, every line is awesome for Luke.
Yeah. You want to grace us with a couple?
Oh, they're the same kind of stuff. What? What is he doing here? There is a scene in the game where the inspector from the first game, he jumps him.
Was he never actually in the first game?
He was
being impersonated in the first game.
Yes, he was in a newspaper clipping in the first game, but that's it.
Yeah, so this is the real him.
This is the real him, but Luke doesn't know that, so he jumps him and tries to rip his face off. And that scene goes on for like 35 seconds. Nice. It's just, and the whole time he's going, come on, it's got to come off.
God. That sounds like Monty.
Sounds
like Monty Python.
There's actually a lot more voice acting in this game than there was in the previous one. At least that's my initial observation, which is both a blessing and a curse, I guess.
Yeah, they're getting more ambitious, like level 5, with what they're doing with DS cards. Have you heard about, is it the Studio Ghibli game that they're like, it's absolutely enormous card because it's got an orchestral soundtrack on it?
Oh my god.
Yeah, I think it's like a 4 GB card, yeah. DS card.
So I guess like future latent games is good, like if you use that, could just be like all
spoken. It's
going
to be like a CDI game. You just point and then video goes.
Yeah, it's going to cost $100 too.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like in Japan, you can totally do premium pricing for something like that.
Yeah, Final Fantasy 13 is like $80 or $90.
Yeah, and DS
Japan.
Games like Dragon Quest IX, it's like, you know, easily the cost of a console game and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But with the Western markets, it always tends to be a bit more rigid. I don't know how that would fly, but if you've already made your money in Japan, you can kind of... kind of subsidize it a little, relatively.
Yeah.
Sure, but there's also economy of scale, you know, so if you've already made a lot of these, then maybe... Because especially with that, in that case, you know, I'm sure Nintendo doesn't manufacture a whole lot of DS cards that are that big, maybe none, before this game, so...
No, that's gotta be breaking new ground.
Yeah. So, you know, the more they make, the cheaper it'll be later on.
WarioWare Touch did not come in that
4 gigabyte card. No, indeed not. Wario Touch probably could be a DSiWare game.
It probably should be a DSiWare game. Mm-hmm. The other thing to note in this game is, and it's kind of funny given what I'm working on right now, and John might appreciate this, is that I actually got the game at a big box retailer that was selling it at a significant discount despite it being a new title.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they basically have it as the same price as the original game.
Huh. And that's been out for ages in America. Like, it's relatively a lot more recent here.
2 years.
In fact, I might have actually paid $1 more for the original game than the second game. Thank you, Walmart. Awesome. But I'm enjoying it, and it still feels a lot like the Phoenix Wright titles to me, in that it's episodic, and that it really is, you know, a cast of characters that are going to move through one title to another. Which I think is almost to the game or the series benefit, because it lets you become attached to the characters in the game, and it makes you really anticipate the next one. The other thing I have to talk about real quick is the Xbox Live 1 versus 100 catastrophe that's out there right now. So
I messed around with this a little over the summer.
Yeah, over the summer they were doing these live ones where, you know...
Have they stopped?
Yeah, they do the extended play version of it, which is basically, it's just everybody is in the mob, but they haven't done a live event in a few weeks.
Really?
Yeah. And what I've come to learn is that people are fucking stupid.
Yep.
Like I got a question. You get what is it, three options for each question. And the question was, Krakow is in what country? Poland, Spain, France. 33% of people got that question right. I'm like, you are all
so literally,
you,
so a donkey that was randomly kicking one answer would have got that equally right.
Yes. I was like, this thing's really easy. And to put it in perspective, the first time I played the game, I came in the last half of it because you can hot join at any point in these extended ones, and I still beat the two people they paired me with who've been playing the whole time, because people are just fucking stupid.
Well, if people aren't really familiar with 1 versus 100, I think maybe a good description would be it's kind of like Family Feud if there was only one correct answer per question.
And only one family.
Yeah, and one big family. But yeah, I mean, the idea is that they ask a question, you kind of get to see out of 100 people in the mob how many of them got it right. And if you're the one, then the more people who get it wrong, the higher your rewards are, basically. And the idea is that at some point you cash out before you get something wrong.
Right. And this was a TV game show,
which is long gone.
Yeah.
Bob Saget was the host.
Kiss of death, Bob Saget.
Wish they would bring him back to do the live one and make it unrated, uncensored.
I totally agree. Not the America's Funniest Home Videos Bob Saget, but the stand-up Bob Saget.
But the Aristocrats Bob Saget.
Yeah.
I could get down with that.
In a way, it was kind of ambitious to decide that they were going to do this thing live. It's essentially a game show live on your console, which is cool. It just, you know, I never got to play it live.
I did, or I watched it. I was in the audience for a couple, and they weren't that interesting. It's like, I'm surprised they're not doing it consistently, because it couldn't have taken that much time and effort to put it together. I mean, the guy probably could have done it from his home.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to kill a half hour. You do get inundated with commercials for the Palm Pre, though.
All right, well, that's going to wrap up new business. We're going to take a break now. When we get back, Greg will be gone. Unfortunately, he couldn't. We recorded it previously, and Greg couldn't be there. We had some scheduling problems. So Greg will be gone temporarily, and in his place, Jeff Callis from Penny Arcade and formerly Nintendo of America, to talk about Geist, and it's going to be a lot of fun. So we'll be right back. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. This week sees us provide some truly worldwide coverage, as well as deliver all the usual great content you've come to expect from NWR.
You'll definitely want to look at our coverage of Tokyo Game Show 2009, provided by our Japan correspondents Matt Walker and James Charlton.
There's also our review of Mario & Luigi 3 Bowser's Inside Story, which Pedro Hernandez says is easily one of the best DS games of the year.
And for Final Fantasy fans, James Jones has written an extensive preview of Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles: The Crystal Bearers.
And don't forget that we have plenty of news, screenshots, and video, as well as exclusive content like Michael Cole's Radio Trivia Podcast Edition. Nintendo World Report, For more than a decade, the best Nintendo coverage on the net. Everybody, we are back for a retroactive segment with very special guest Jeff Callis. Jeff works at Penny Arcade now.
I don't think I'm that special.
You are special.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
In a previous life, Jeff was a producer at Nintendo of America for some of their second-party development, I guess. I'm not exactly sure all the details, so we'll find out in a minute. We'll be talking about guys today, of course, as well as some Penny Arcade and PAX stuff. But in retroactive fashion, we'll also have a second week of Guys Talk, where we'll probably have more comments from the users after everybody's had a chance to play the game more. And so Greg will be back next week for retroactive, and he'll tell us about his thoughts on Guys, and we'll discuss all that next week. So he's not going to be left out. So anyway, with all that set aside, first, Jeff, welcome to Radio Free Nintendo.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
We're actually really excited to have you. I'm very excited. I guess I've known you for a few years, but you seem to remember the story of how we met better than I do. So do you want to tell that
now? I will enlighten your listeners here. So one of my very first big projects was Eternal Darkness.
Oh, and, wow. Okay. We've done that on Retroactive as well.
So we sat in a big meeting. Now, this is I'm talking about me and Silicon Knights and other people from Nintendo, and we all sat around, and the game was almost done on the N64. I mean, it was almost done. And we were launching the GameCube, and we came to this decision for various reasons. You know, it's easier to launch a new franchise with the launch of a console. We'll be able to get more voice, you know, improved engine, you know, really give this game its best chance to shine. And we made this very, very difficult decision to not launch it on the N64 and go ahead and launch it on the GameCube. And back then I was young and naive, and I'd actually go out and read the press on the games I was working on, which I've learned since not to.
But you're welcome.
Very wise.
Yeah, but at the time when we announced it, everyone was really positive, except for this Metz guy. and what some website, he wrote this huge diatribe about what a travesty this is, and it should come out on the N64, and it should never come out on GameCube. And for some reason, that stuck to me. So the next E3, the big unveiling of the GameCube, and it's one of the launch titles, and we've got the great display and the big booth, and I'm in there demoing the hell out of this game. And this guy comes up, and he's playing it, and I glance down at his name tag.
Oh,
and
wow.
Sure enough, it says Jonathan Metz.
I can't believe we met that long ago. That's
what an ass. And he's playing the game on the GameCube, and I wait till he gets done, and I walk up to him, and I go, "So, what do you think? Do you still think it should have been longed on the N64? And he's like, "Yep." And that was it.
That was just a mess with you. No, I actually remember that now that you tell the story. Wow,
see,
I can't believe it was
that
long ago. I thought we had met at a party or something years later. That is insane.
That was, yes. I still think it should have been on the N64, even after playing the GameCube version. You still think that?
No, I mean, I love how the game turned out. I'm a very, very big fan of Eternal Darkness. So I probably, when I said no to you, to your face, I probably was doing it for effect, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's not like it mattered at that point what I thought, or if it ever did.
I can honestly say your opinion had no bearing on the development of that title.
I'm sure.
All right, I don't want to dissuade you and pop your ego. Well, I did want to pop your ego a little bit. But
you know, that editorial I wrote, I don't think it was I was hating on GameCube or the GameCube version or anything. We hadn't even seen it at that point. It was all rumored. It was like, and it was about at the time there were also rumors about Dinosaur Planet, which of course that became Star Fox Adventures on GameCube, and there was a rumor about Conker, which was untrue because that did come out on N64. And it wasn't specifically about Eternal Darkness. It was kind of this this movement, and this seems to happen at the end of every console cycle where, you know, certain games get pushed, and there are, I think, some pretty good logical reasons not to do that. And in the case of Eternal Darkness, I mean, one of them I said is there's no way these games are going to be finished for launch, and that was definitely true in, you know, in both of the ones that did get pushed. So
yeah,
it's not trivial to change platforms like that.
We could have a whole nother discussion on why that game didn't make launch. It should have made launch. To be honest, guys, I haven't been with Nintendo over 5 years. I'm still afraid of the Nintendo police. Like, yeah. Right now, I'm afraid if I say the wrong thing, there's a SWAT team dressed in plumber coveralls going to swoop down on top of me and
take
me away.
Do you really think Nintendo gives a shit about Geist at this point, if they ever did?
Well, they're a very image-conscious company, and yeah. To be honest, even years later, I still refer to Nintendo as we sometimes, not the console, but as me being part of the group.
So you're saying that once you get N, you can never get out.
Oh, God. Is this why we
That's
have
it.
You here,
Interview
John?
Over. I'm done. I'm out of here.
No, oh, my God.
That was I want to throw up.
Okay, at least I'm not the one who made the first bad pun of the night.
Oh, don't worry. I'm sure in the recorded sessions before this, John will have made like 30. It's okay.
Fair enough.
Now, Jeff, you were an associate producer at Nintendo of America, right?
That was my official title, but so I worked in the area known as the Treehouse, which was NOA, Nintendo of America's development group. The job kind of evolved over the years as I was there. I was at Nintendo a total of 11 and a half years. Started answering the phone when you needed to find the hammer in Zelda, you know, as the gameplay counselor.
Oh, nice.
And,
that's awesome.
Yeah, I can still tell you exactly how to find the grappling beam in Super Metroid from memory. I'll never be able to get rid of that. And then through to QA, to product test, and then from there got the opportunity to help out on production games, and eventually got hired full-time as an associate producer. But producer is different for every company. Like, most of the time, my job was mostly just to know the game as well as possible and then coordinate with the other departments, you know, whether it's PR or, you know, the guys making the manual or whatever. That was kind of my job, to make sure everyone who needed information about the game got it somewhere. So almost like a giant human switchboard of information. Some games required a lot more hands-on, like Eternal Darkness and Geist, where you were actually involved in script edits and helping with level design, and a lot of it depended on how much of an interest NCL, you know, the parent company back in Japan, how much of an interest they took directly in the game. Because if Miyamoto's group is hands-on, you're going to back off a little bit and kind of let them run things. So
right. So with a game like Geist, I mean, we've heard that Miyamoto came up with some of the ideas for possessing inanimate objects and things like that. I mean, is that true or is that apocryphal?
All right, it is time for my how Geist ended up with possession object story. Boy, I don't know how far back to go. N-Space brought the basic concept to NOA of, hey, let's do this really cool first-person shooter, but instead of always being the same character, what if you could possess different characters and, you know, jump from person to person? So the original gameplay prototype they brought us was this very nice-looking, polished, you know, starting cutscene, you get separated from your body, and you hop into different soldiers with different weapons, and you shoot. And we thought there was enough core gameplay mechanic. The gameplay mechanic of possession was fun. It was fun to jump from body to body. And so we brought it to Japan, and they bought off on the concept, and they put the deal in place. Well, over the course of development, you know, things change, people get inspired. And, boy, the meeting, I can't remember if it happened in Japan or if it happened in Orlando, where N-Space is located, but I think it happened in Japan before I was there. But when they were talking to N-Space, I wasn't on this particular trip, but they're like, Miyamoto-san said something about, boy, it'd be really fun if I could possess objects. And no one really paid any attention to it. And they kind of, oh yeah, that would be fun, da-da-da-da-da. And like several weeks later, there was a follow-up meeting, and the other gentleman from NCL that were working on the project came to Endspace and were like, yeah, we didn't realize he was serious, but he's really serious about making this game about possessing objects. And they're like, oh, well, okay, how do we do that? How do we make that work? And kind of from there, the game evolved from being a first-person shooter to being a first-person adventurer, because it wasn't always about shooting your way through the level. It was about, okay, now I need a problem solve. And what would be the purpose of possessing objects? And that's where the whole aura thing came about, and as an extension of this one idea that this genius game designer threw out.
Yeah, I remember when I first heard about the objects thing, I thought, that just sounds really hokey. And then you see it in action and you're possessing a bowl of dog food, and it's like, it seems really goofy, but at the same time, it fits in so well with the theme of being a poltergeist and, you know, manipulating all the environment in order to scare people.
Boy, if there's one thing I could do, I would go back to that first demo and make it a different object besides dog food.
The dog food.
That's what it's known as now.
I bet.
It is.
There are so many things you can... Actually, my favorite so far, I'm maybe halfway through the game, and my favorite one so far is you possess a computer screen and the guy comes over to use it, and it starts doing like pop-up windows of apparently porn ads and stuff like that, and the guy freaks out because he thinks he's going to get in trouble with his boss, I guess.
You see, I would have done something like that, or I think one of the coolest... Boy, it's been a long time since I played this game, so I'm going to forget a lot of stuff. I really thought the idea of possessing the keypad to learn the code... was, you know, I would have liked to have seen more puzzles like that. And then the one where you possess the mirror and make the scary image of the girl, things like that, I think would have played better in a demo. But
right. It's funny that you worked on Eternal Darkness and then Geist worked with them, at least.
Yes.
But there's an interesting connection. And then Eternal Darkness, the game is kind of playing all these poltergeist kind of tricks on the player in a more metaphysical way. Whereas in Geist, you are now the trickster and you're playing all these, you know, very similar kinds of pranks, but now you're playing them on the characters for a game mechanic purpose rather than just really pure aesthetics, which it is in Eternal Darkness.
Yeah, those two games were separated by at least in a few years, so it was never a conscious design decision, but obviously when you have a lot of the same people, even from an NCL side, working on projects, sometimes those concepts will bleed over from one project to another.
Yeah. So one of the things that has struck me as I'm playing through it now is that the game is really quite violent. And it's interesting to hear that people like Miyamoto were involved, at least in some supervising capacity, just because, you know, he's known as kind of a guy who doesn't really like violence in games, or at least not in his own games. And I'm playing this and, you can shoot dogs and kill them. There's a cutscene where a guy gets nicked in his Achilles heel and then he falls. It's like straight out of Kill Bill Volume 1.
Yeah.
You know, it slashes the guy's heel and then he falls over and then you stab him in the neck. And I was like, wow, I can't believe Nintendo published this. I mean, it's pretty brutal in some parts.
Well, you know, but it wasn't violent for violence sake. It was never...
No.
It's always within the structure of the story and the setting. I mean, the same thing with Eternal Darkness is it's always... the violence was never gratuitous. It's no... My memory escapes me. That horrible fighting game that never got released, but everyone seems to have a bootleg copy of.
Oh, the Wu-Tang
Thrill
fighting game.
Thrill Kill,
something like that.
That turned into the Wu-Tang game. They're the same game.
Yeah. So it was always there, you know, to support the story. With that being said, you know, the game was originally designed to be a U.S. release. It was designed to appeal to the American audience, and then we decided, well, let's go ahead and try to make it, you know, fit multiple audiences. And so they skewed it a little more, and that's kind of where the object possession stuff comes in, is they said, okay, we want to make it appeal to a wider U.S. market. Unfortunately, when all things said and done, when the game finally did come out, it only came out in the U.S., which, you know, I think was... It was frustrating on my side, because it was like, we made all these changes, and now it doesn't exactly appeal to the U.S. first-person shooter audience. So it had a really hard time finding an initial audience because of the changes we'd made to make it more appealing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, can you say anything about the sales of the game? I mean, were you...
I have no idea.
were people? Did you get a sense that people were pleased with them or not pleased with how it was doing?
Oh, you know, the problem with Nintendo is you've got such high standards to hit with every sale. I mean, unless the game sells a million copies, it's not a hit. Mm-hmm. So it's a great goal to try to hit. There's a great standard there, but it's frustrating when your critical successes don't turn into commercial ones. I think it did all right. Once a game is approved in test and lot check and goes to production, I usually stop and don't, you know, unless aside for occasional press, I was done with it. I was okay, move on to the next game or finish up the other project I have going on or something like that. But we can go back and talk about the violence and the stuff we didn't include in the game.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, yes.
No. Well, see, I don't want to get anyone in trouble. I still have friends at N-Space. It was just weird what, for different territories, what's considered too much and what isn't. For example, the scene, well, I hope I'm not spoiling this for anyone who hasn't played yet, where you have to get rid of the soldiers in the kitchen by cooking. Their method of death was very controversial for Japan. Like, they were very worried about poisoning.
Interesting.
Meanwhile, there was sketched out, and it was storyboarded, a scene in which one of the evil spirits possessed someone and shot his own host in the head. which, you know, you can't have somebody committing suicide in a Nintendo game. That's just not good. And but they had no problem with that initially, and then we had to explain.
Persona to indoctrinate their society.
It's well, yeah. It's just, you know, different things like poisonous gas, much scarier. Knives were always a bigger issue with when you're making a game specifically for Japan. So
I have several more questions I want to ask, but before I do that, maybe we should kind of go around because the three of us have been playing this game over the past week, and maybe we can talk about whether this is our first time and what our experiences with it so far, maybe some thoughts. James, you've played it before, right?
Not a lot, but yeah, okay. I had played it some. It's easily the most time I've had, you know, hands-on with the game since before, where, you know, I played it a little bit, and it's kind of surprising some of the things that I've seen in the game, and I'm not quite sure why they surprised me, if that makes sense. Like, it seems logical that how you interact with these objects and use them for the sake of basically solving the game's puzzles. But it always seems to me that sometimes, you know, it's kind of a surprise what the decision was on how to solve this particular feat. And I think a good example, especially with discussing this last one, was basically you're asked to deal with a bunch of guards while you're the cook in the cafeteria of this place. And the answer is to feed them rat poison, which, in light of the previous conversation, seems kind of amusing. But, you know, I had the rat poison. I had, you know, I understood where I needed to put it. But for the life of me, I couldn't figure out that, you know, I was supposed to put it in the soup. But for the life of me, I couldn't figure out I had to go get the soup. Like, I didn't know where it was. I didn't know I needed to go get it. And then when I got it, I'm like, why did this take that much mental arithmetic to figure out?
Yeah, that's the one thing. It doesn't do a very good job of kind of nudging you in the direction to go to solve a puzzle. Like, early on in the game, you have to go to one of the computers, and it's one of the ones where you punch in the code. Like, it gives you the code, and then you walk up to the door, and you punch it in. And for some reason, I didn't see in that room, like, because you go to one of the guys standing there, and he's like, yeah, well, you know, I've unlocked the computers, you can get the code, da-da-da. But when you come around, the computer that you actually have to go to is on your left. And the way you walk into the room, you don't immediately see it. You see the two computers that you kind of saw the first time you came through. And for some reason, I just could not see that third computer. And it's just like kind of weird stuff like that. Like, if it would have just offered you more of a hint on where to go, it probably would have played a little bit smoother.
I have a thought that ties in with what you guys just said. But Jeff, I know that we actually have an interview with you on the site from back when Geist was about to come out. And I was reading over that in preparation, and at one point you described it as a first-person adventure, and obviously you're trying to make some connections with very successful Metroid Prime franchise. And I was playing it last night, and you know, I'm the ghost, and I'm moving my cursor all over the room at different objects to see what I can interact with. And I thought, you know, this doesn't feel like Metroid Prime to me. It feels like a point-and-click adventure. You know, in the way that the puzzles are put together, you have to go gather one or two inventory items mm-hmm. and maybe combine them or use them in a specific place. And you kind of have to think, well, if I was there, how would I solve this? They're very environmental puzzles, not the abstract kind of technology-based gamey stuff in Metroid Prime, but more like a little bit more based in reality in that, you know, how would I solve this if I was really there, and you kind of go through your logic. And it just made me think of King's Quest and, you know, stuff like that, Monkey Island.
Well, that's good. Those are some of my favorite games, and if we can just steal just a little tiny fraction of the magic of some of those titles, then that was the goal. Yeah, when we described it as a first-person adventure, from a PR standpoint, yes, you wanted to associate yourself with the very popular and best-selling Metroid Prime series, but the puzzles were designed in a more classic adventure game style where you're exactly, you described the point and click. Although I don't think it was ever, you know, discussed, hey, let's make these puzzles feel more like an adventure game. it was just the way that the natural progression of the game development took. And then looking back on it, you know, because the game's designed first, and then you figure out once it's designed how best to market what exists. Nintendo is never one of those to drive their game development based on marketing.
Yeah. Well, one place that I think Geist really carves out a unique niche for itself is in the boss battles. And I've only played a couple up to the point where I am at the game, but I thought both of them were really, really interesting, and just things that I don't think I've ever done or even thought about doing in a game before.
Really? Because some of them pissed the hell out of me.
Yes. I agree entirely.
The second one, when you're in the room with four or five guards and you're trying to kill the guy Cord, that one was very difficult, and it took me several tries, but I did beat it. I mean, I still like the setup of it. I thought maybe it needed to be tweaked a little bit for balance, but I still thought it was a really cool idea.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking that one was really irritating until I realized that I was supposed to just possess the grenades on the floor.
Yeah, then it becomes really easy.
Yeah, because they're so small that I couldn't really see the hue on them because I was trying to keep distance. Because if you can keep distance, basically, he can't hit you.
Yeah.
But you'd have to shoot him like 56,000 times to beat him.
The one I hate is throwing my freaking grenade inside the opening of that goddamn snail.
No.
That's the one that I, if I could go back at all, I would. Can we please just make the hit detection on that opening a little wider?
You either have to get like right on top of him or throw like five and hope one of them lands in there while he's healing himself.
For me, for going back and looking at a game like this, and I'm proud of what happened, and Endspace is a fantastic developer, and I love them, but all you end up seeing is the flaws. You're like, oh, if only we had more time to do this, or if only we had been able to fit in another month of balance testing, or, you know, what if we had found this trick earlier in the development instead of the end of the development, and we could have reapplied it to the whole game. So
it's like you're too close to it.
I see more potential of what it could have been. You know, I'm still, like I said, I'm very proud of the final product, and my hat's off to Endspace for what they did. But yeah, they're you know, no game, at least no game I've ever worked on, is actually achieves 100% of what you set out to do with it. You go back and you see all those hours spent trying to get something right that maybe just never quite clicked just perfectly the way you wanted it to.
One thing that I think moved it more towards a first-person adventure versus the first-person shooter was how the story was told, I guess by Gigi, mostly, as she addresses you. So you have the silent protagonist that we see in a lot of games, that especially Nintendo publishes, where the story is being told by, you know, an omniscient or nearly omniscient either narrator or character who sort of guides you along. And in a way, I thought it was kind of interesting that not only was she there as a tutorial object, essentially, she also provided the ability to create the story and explain what's going on later. And in the end, you almost empathize with her, which is not something that you normally do with tutorial and help characters.
Oh, yeah. I mean, her design, she was always meant to be an integral part of the story. She was always meant to factor into the Volks family, and you know, that explained her presence. She was never there just to be there. Funny aside story, the reason she is named Gigi is because she was the ghost girl for a long time and took a long time to figure out what to name her. She was just ghost girl for a long time. And so in all the documentation, she was just Gigi. And eventually... that became her name. So
that's hilarious.
That's my director's note portion of the commentary.
You heard it right here.
That's right.
That's great.
The only part that I didn't seem to grasp from how the story was being told, I mean, generally speaking, first-person shooter stories are, in this case, first-person adventure, but don't tell the stories particularly narrowly focused so you can understand exactly what's going on. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, like, there's only one element of it, which was, you know, when they you just stumble on the house. Which I guess was intentional, but you know how when you start looking at objects, I guess it starts explaining, well, this is where, I can't remember what their aunt's name was. This is where she lived. I was like, who is that? And then, you know, later in the story, you realize who that was. But it was kind of an interesting twist because it never really clicked with me that she was who she is without ruining who that is until I stumbled on the house.
Thanks for not spoiling it.
Yeah.
I'm not that far yet.
Yeah, isn't the statute of limitations on spoilers kind of out? I guess it isn't when you're calling for all of your listeners to replay a title.
Yeah, exactly. We try to avoid them for the next couple weeks. Yeah, we heard from a lot of listeners who said that they had bought the game and had just never finished it. So they were like really looking forward to going back and giving it the time that it deserves. And then quite a few other people said, I always wanted to play that, but I never got around to it. So apparently there's a shortage on Gamefly now, and like people are really going out to pick it up.
It's a resurgence.
Now, you talked about going back and seeing, you know, thinking about a lot of things that you would have changed. I'm curious whether the controls would be one of them, because there's definitely a sluggish feel to turning and aiming, and there's no option to adjust it either. So, I mean, can you say anything about how that came to be?
Well, yeah, ideally, I'd love to go back and be able to learn from what we now know is let's adjust the sensitivity on the turn. But back then, it was we wanted you, when you were in the host, to feel trapped, to feel slow and encumbered. Well, depending on the host, obviously. When you're in a rat, it's a little different, you know, feel low to the ground fast, but
yeah.
And then as a spirit, be a little more freeing. But boy, I don't remember, we used to have these charts about, you know, how far to push the x-axis to get certain speeds, but a lot of that escapes my memory.
Yeah.
At the time, but yeah, you know, it's we wanted each host to feel unique and different, and the happy medium in between, you know, when you're with inside Joe Average host, probably felt too Joe Average by the time we were done. Because as we all know, players don't want realism. They want to, you know, they want to feel empowered, and, you know, they want to feel like their avatar is better than reality. So,
all right. So I think we've covered most of the topics that I brought in here today. We had a few questions from the listeners. So Shy Guy asked, do you think most of the game's best tricks are in the first few levels?
Boy, that's actually a good question, because ideally, there's a team at Sega, the guys who did Sonic. AM2, is that the name of the group?
Sonic Team did Sonic.
Yeah, the Sonic Team. They would design the first levels last, because by the time you get to that point, you've learned all the cool tricks and you've learned how best to utilize your engine. And so you end up presenting the best stuff right at the beginning. You know, everything you've learned throughout your development cycle. And there was a little bit, and Endspace had worked very closely with that team on some arcade titles. So they took a little bit of that design philosophy with them. So some of it is, yes, we wanted to front load it a little bit so that you get that window of opportunity to capture a player's imagination and attention. Hearing how many people bought it and then never finished it, it seems we failed.
Well, it could be that they played through all the best parts in the beginning, and then when it slowed down or thinned out more, maybe that's when they stop playing.
Yeah, where it got a little story heavy or the combat got a little different, where you're actually fighting, you know, people that can see ghosts. The other part of it is, as with most development, you know, you get rushed towards the end, and sometimes you don't have enough time to go back and give the ending or the middle sections as much polish as you wish you could. You know, but that's with every game. That's not specific to this game.
Well, Golden Phoenix asked whether the game was rushed, and she also asked, were there any significant problems in the development process?
Every development process has significant problems. I have yet to encounter a dev cycle that didn't have
another user, I think it was one of our staff members, described Geist as having gone through development hell. I don't know if you would characterize it that way.
When you
way,
redesign the entire game around object possession, it ceases being the game you originally had. Mm-hmm. So it's like you're developing two games. You know, were we rushed? No, never, not really. But at the same time, you're trying to hit dates, and you got to do it. I think one of the things that happened because the game took a drastic development shift is that the graphic engine got dated faster than it should have. When they first brought it to us, it looked great. And I think it holds up pretty well, but, you know, maybe that's one of the things that if we go back, add more polygons to the models, give them a few more animations, just make everything look crisper and shinier.
I don't think the graphics are a problem.
I think it still looks good.
Playing it now, I think it looks pretty good.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, that was one of the weird things I used to hear when it first came out. Again, back when I was paying attention to the press, a lot of the knocks were on the graphics, and I just never saw it. And I think I came to the realization that just when people looked at it as simply a first-person shooter, there are so many graphically gorgeous first-person shooters that if you're comparing it to that, then yeah, it's not going to be up there with the fanciest new FPS engine, which I think at the time was Half-Life-ish.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing I will say about it is the only kind of knock I had in that department was the fact that it just kind of the overall look of the game, not the actual graphics engine, but like the menus and everything, could probably be a little bit more polished. Like, they just seemed kind of, you know, different fonts all over the place, and, you know, just from that perspective, it just didn't seem like it wasn't presented kind of in a cohesive manner.
Yeah, I don't know that I completely agree with you, but, you know, UI is part of, as game development has progressed, people realize is more and more important, and so it's a lot more specialized field now than it was back then.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that where the game really shines graphically is, number one, in the virtual reality thing near the beginning of the game, with it, you know, it's like the paradise and the computer is talking to you.
Yeah.
That is so gorgeous, and I don't know if there's a chance to kind of revisit that later in the game. I really hope there is, because it's just so striking and different and really interesting to look at and to float around in. And then just in general, I really like the look of the world when you're out of a body, you know, when you're without a host and you're floating around and you see the auras and everything, and it's all slowed down, almost frozen time, not quite. So everything's moving really slowly. That is great presentation. And you do really get a feel that you're kind of floating around, you know, without a body, that you're not running, you're not jumping around or anything. You are a ghost. I love how when you pass through fences and grates and people, that the screen kind of turns reddish a little bit, you know, to indicate that you're inside of an object. That's really good shit. That's very effective.
Thank you very much for saying that. I don't for me, but for the development team for Endspace. I think they did really good work, and I don't think they got the credit they deserved for the amount of labor and love they poured into this title. So hopefully they'll and I'm not just saying that because I think they're going to listen to this podcast. Actually, funny story, Dan, who's I believe his title is the president right now. He posted some pictures on Facebook yesterday. Apparently their server room had some smoke coming out of it, and
awesome.
posted pictures of the fire department showing up. So in the little comment section, I like, well, maybe Raimi was trying to scare your IT manager so he could possess him. And the first comment back said, I hate you. But then he changed it to like, well, no, my aura only turned yellow. So it was complete coincidence that this was all happening at the same time. But yeah, I still try to keep in touch with those guys, and I really wish I'd had a chance to work with that team more and see those guys more often, because they were a talented bunch.
Striker Obi, he's actually going to be on the show next week. He's a co-founder of our podcast. But I solicited a question from him, and he wanted to know what it was like working under NCL's Iron Fist. I guess this might be a general, maybe not even specific to Geist, but in general, I mean, dude, what were your thoughts on working with NCL?
See, now I'm waiting for the police to show up if I slip up. No, actually, I take that back. I learned so much from those guys, and those guys are awesome. Someday off the record, I'll tell you all sorts of fun stories. But they're just simple things that you don't think about when you're designing titles that they just know intuitively. Simple things like item placement, or where, you know, you always present the player with an obstacle. And then shortly after the obstacle is the object to get past the obstacle. But with an example of how that object is used. So then the player immediately goes, oh, hey, I just saw this wall that needs a sledgehammer. I know that once I pick this sledgehammer up, I can go to the room previously and use it. And just, you know, simple, you're sitting there going, duh, well, that makes perfect sense. Well, it's amazing how much game design doesn't realize that that's what you need to do. And it's very apparent. And they use a thing called the rule of three, where most boss battles have three patterns or three types of attacks or three cycles.
Yes.
They've found that that's the most engaging.
The most predictable kind of Zelda boss.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, it works really well.
I think it's overused a little in some series, especially Zelda. But yeah.
Well, that might be a debate for another time. But just, you know, having these basic core rules to use as you work on titles was just getting game design 101 from some of the masters. It's fantastic. Plus, you know, they're really good sake drinkers, and they'll put you under the table in a second.
Now, how is it to actually work with them day to day, though? Like, when they show up in the office, is there like this buzz going on?
It depends on who you're working with. Everyone I worked with directly was fantastic, and when I did work with them directly, we would go out to a developer for, you know, a week at a time, and you'd sit in the meeting room, and you'd sit in this conference room for 12, 14 hours, and just hammer. You'd go over each level in just incredibly fine detail. You know, giant printouts of the maps and the items and the enemies, and you'd verbally walk through the gameplay of each level. And so it was camaraderie. It wasn't, there was never, oh, these folks are here and they're going to tell me what to do. It was,
yeah,
what can we do to make this a better project?
Well, that's everything I had for guys. James and John, this would be your chance if you have any kind of final thoughts or questions for Jeff before we move on.
Sure. Well, one thing that I noticed, and I was thinking about this earlier, is that, you know, the ammo in the game is unlimited in every respect. There's no limit on ammunition. And in some of the earlier stages where there are multiple, where there's actually a level in particular where you basically have to gum through a bunch of enemies, or you can, you know, go in there and possess items to get rid of them. But there's actually a frightened guard behind the doorway, and he respawns. So if you dispose of him, mm-hmm. you get another one. And what I thought, what made me think about this, is that the game's ammo really isn't bullets. It's more bodies, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And that they're disposable in the same way that ammunition and most shooters are disposable. Which, I guess, if you think about it as a first-person adventure, it makes a lot more sense that way.
Yeah, it was... We always erred on the side of fun. You want to err on the side of, let's not really piss off our player by taking the one soldier in a room full of soldiers that you can possess and accidentally having him die in a grenade blast. And then, oh, well, okay. Now I'll go play with this valve.
Yeah.
That's no fun. Mm-hmm. So at some points we had to bend the rules a little bit and give you more fun. And you know, we did play tests with limited ammo and things, and it wasn't the same game experience. The ultimate decision was made, well, let's give the player all the tools necessary to navigate the level, you know, the puzzles and get through, and without having to worry about something else to stretch their brains besides the puzzles.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a smart choice, because kind of, you know, as you play through the game, you kind of realize that it's more puzzle oriented, and, you know, trying to shoehorn kind of a first person shooter sort of, you know, oh, you're running out of ammo, oh, you need to conserve ammo, that kind of thing. It just kind of would have gotten in the way, I think.
Yeah, that's what we found when we tested it that way, is it added a level of frustration that didn't need to be there.
Yeah. And I agree.
And I can see in some of the boss battles where if you had limited ammo, it would be completely a different game, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, can you imagine running out of grenades when you're trying to hit that stupid snail?
Oh, I would have just smashed the game into pieces. There was, before I realized that the bodies respawn, a moment where I was in that situation you were talking about where I lost my guard. and there's like six of them just walking around. I'm like, well, damn it. How am I supposed to scare these bastards? I'm just sitting there, and I think I possessed some object on the wall that I used to scare the initial guard, and just sat there so I didn't die. And I'm like, what am I going to do? And so I'm like, well, screw it. I'll just see how far I can get before I run into a door, and which wasn't very far. And I turn around, and there's this guard, like, hiding in the corner, like, they cowered over. I'm like, well, that's convenient. Yeah. Just go over there and take him and just start killing everything.
We put him there just for you.
Awesome.
Just for you.
Best service.
Now, the one question I had was about the story, because that's one of the things that impressed me right off the bat was the fact that, you know, the story, it presents you kind of with a whole bunch of questions and a whole bunch of loose ends that you want to see tied up. You know, like, who is the Volks Corporation? Why are they doing this? Why are they separating the souls of these people? You know, who's this Raimi guy? Why him? So I was just, if you could give some background on the story and, you know, who wrote it, how much input Nintendo had on it.
You know, I'm going to lay all of the credit at Endspace's feet. That was all them. They had some incredibly smart folks working for them. You know, fleshing out some of the details was collaborative with NCL and NOA. You know, maybe the motivation for a particular level or how do we fit this element from the overall story into the game and those sort of things. But yeah, they had fleshed out the whole story pretty well and then just kind of had this universe already well-defined. Mm-hmm. And when the gameplay kind of changed up on them, it actually allowed them to express more of the story than they were going to able to prior. So it was kind of a blessing in disguise. Yep. That it was, you know, you're able to get a lot more of it. But yeah, that's... Boy, I don't want to say anyone by name because I'm not sure exactly who over there did. I think there was one driving person behind it, but if it wasn't him, I don't want to call him out. But there was several people that I know put their thoughts and energies into that, and that was more them than us.
Yeah, I just thought that, you know, it had kind of all the elements that could turn into some stereotypical cliche story, but it wasn't at all what I expected.
That was good on them.
Yeah, they did a really good job.
I think everything ties back into each other really well, but still leaves enough open that there was the potential for follow-ups if we were fortunate enough.
Any chance of a Geist 2? Have you heard anything?
Well, Nintendo owns the IP, right?
Mm.
You know, and Endspace is kind of independent. They've got, you know, they're doing some really cool stuff.
They have the Call of Duty stuff on DS, which is very good.
Yes, their first-person technology on DS is fantastic. And I'm glad to see that they're leveraging that. They've got some other projects in the work, I think. But, you know, if I had anything to say with it, I'd try to get them to work together or find a way to magically grant them back their own IP at $0 cost to them.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I don't have that power. So theoretically, you know, Nintendo could always find somebody else to do it, but I would hope that they would never do that.
Yeah.
Who knows? Retro Studios is still a mystery right now. What they're working on could be Geist. I doubt it.
We could call up Michael Kelbaugh and ask him, find out.
Yeah.
Hey, what are you working on down there?
You know, I call him every week and he never tells me.
Yeah. He was my boss in product testing.
Really?
He was the head of the product testing department and good guy. I'm so glad that he ended up in charge of Retro. I think he's one of the best things that's happened to that group down there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, for sure. So I guess it's time to move on to some Penny Arcade stuff. Now, of course, you now work for Penny Arcade, and what's your role there now?
Well, good question. So we're not that big. I'm trying to think how many total employees we have now. 9, 10, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. So a little bit of everything. My official title has nothing to do with producing. It's actually a sales manager. Yeah, talk about just completely switching roles. You know, my day-to-day stuff is ad sales, but because Penny Arcade only advertises things we endorse, I end up looking at a lot of the product before I bring it to Gabe and Tycho to make sure that it, you know, if I think it's cool enough, they'll approve it for advertising. I also, and this is where my actual job experience comes into play, I'm also the content manager for our independent games portal site, the playgreenhouse.com. Yeah, so part of my job when I was at Nintendo was to evaluate games for publication, obviously, and or localization. Kind of what Mario Club did. Except not quite as formal. So I was able to take those skills in terms of evaluation and trying to find those diamonds in the rough and apply them to Greenhouse.
I think you've done a good job based on, you know, the games that I've seen on Greenhouse.
Well, I appreciate that. We are actually currently undergoing a switch with our tech partner, so things have kind of ground to a halt. We're not releasing as much new titles as I wish I could. Because as with anything involving lawyers, it takes longer than you think it should. So once we get some contracts finished up in terms of the, you know, hooking up with this new tech partner, I'm hoping we can unleash the floodgates and really get a chance for some of these indie games that go below the radar that no one's heard of, to get them some spotlight time and get them some publicity so that people will see there's some really great games out there that just, yeah, kind of like what you're doing here with guys, people might miss, mm-hmm. and they yeah. should go back and take a look at it. So,
difference is we're not selling guys.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're just advocating it, I guess.
Although I guess we moved a few copies on Amazon from the looks of it. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Oh, yeah. You guys are, and I'm sure the royalty effects are still in effect. And well, it's only if they're selling them new, I suppose. The used stuff, who knows?
I mean, we do accept kickbacks. I'll just be wide open with that. Anything you got, we will take it.
Let's see. I think I have just miscellaneous Nintendo swag.
Jeff, are you involved with the Penny Arcade Adventures?
Not directly.
Can you tell me when episode 3 is coming? Because I really want to play it.
So my favorite quote about this is someone asked that very same question to the guys at PAX. And Jerry's answer was, first, you need to go out and buy a hat. And then hold on to it. And that's all I can say about episode 3.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. Well, see, I don't ever want to be in the position. You think the Nintendo police are scary? Wait till you get Gabe and Tycho marching into your door because you told something before they announced it. Boy,
yeah,
that would be bad news.
Yeah, I bet.
They don't have to deal with corporate regulations.
We're looking for that world exclusive. We're looking for it.
That's right.
Anything.
That's true. So, yeah, between, and then, you know, with the special projects that come up around here, the PAX. PAX Prime, I guess we're calling it, and then the PAX East coming up, and of course Child's Play, and you know, just kind of get your fingers in all of the different things that we do around here.
Yeah, Child's Play is a fantastic charity. We've been supporting that for a few years now. You know, for those listeners who haven't been with us for quite as long, we actually have an interview with Mike Rahulik or Gabe from Penny Arcade about Child's Play that we did almost 2 years ago, I think, and that's still on iTunes, so you can go back and listen to that to find more about Child's Play. But I wanted to ask you about PAX. I mean, you were pretty heavily involved with it, of course, the event that just happened a couple weeks ago. So can you give us maybe a little bit of a postmortem on the expo?
Wow.
Yeah, sorry, it's a big question.
But... Yeah. It was great.
Solid answer.
Of course, yeah, what am I going to say? But I'll tell you, I PAX is always such an emotional high for me. It reaffirms why I'm in this industry. The amount of joy involved in gaming, and it's not, yeah, it helps to have great games, but it's about the community of people that play them. And PAX brings these people together. Someone said it in a, I think it was a forum post, in regards to something Will Wheaton had said during the show, and PAX isn't a con, it's a giant goddamn family reunion. And and I really feel that. It's just, you know, these people get the inside jokes. They understand the internet references, and when you're discussing strategy on how to take out that last zombie and that, you know, level Left 4 Dead, they're quick with a suggestion. They know what you're talking about and aren't going to call the police on you for having some overheard some weird conversation out in the street.
What is Mike and Jerry's involvement in PAX in terms of planning it? I mean, how involved do they really get? Because I know at the show itself, they mainly just wander around and sort of let it go on autopilot. You know, they've set everything in motion, so they mainly try to enjoy the show. But I mean, leading up to that, are they involved in a lot of decision making?
Oh, yeah, of course. Almost all the content runs directly through them in terms of, you know, the what kind of panels and things like that. I mean, a lot of it has gotten not automated, but, you know, they've got their army of us to try to help get through that.
Right.
But, yeah, in terms of themes and content, you know, and they'll be quick to suggest new ideas on ways to do that. For example, with all these people showing up, the lines are always really difficult, and they found someone last year who runs games for people that are waiting in line to do things, you know, using SMS messaging answers and things like that. And so they're like, okay, we got to include this. This will help alleviate a lot of that boredom that people have to suffer waiting to get into the concerts or whatever. So sure enough, we contacted them and got it over. And their baby really is that Omegathon. I mean, that is, they spend forever trying to figure out which games fit in the Omegathon and brainstorming on what makes the best finale.
PAX has been, you know, they've said it like doubles in size every year or whatever. I mean, it's gotten really big. I think this year's was actually bigger than this year's E3. So do you feel like, you know, the bigger it gets, the better, or do you feel like there's a limit or maybe a diminishing returns in terms, you know, by the size of this? Or is that what PAX East is aimed at? I mean, you're trying to just kind of siphon off some of it to manage the size.
Well, I mean, we already kind of ran into that problem this year, as we ran into a limit on how many tickets the venue would allow us to sell. And so, you know, that's unfortunate. We have to, you know, apparently you have to follow some sort of fire safety guidelines. I don't know, some yeah, exactly.
Old wives' tales.
It's a good problem to have, but, you know.
Yeah, but at the same time, you want everyone who that wants to attend be able to attend. So we're always looking for more space. We had a new room in the convention center. Next year there's actually a whole new building that was under construction this year that we'll be able to take over and get some more floor space to bring in more people. But East, you know, there has always been demand for a show like this on the East Coast. And really, the East Coast, aside from when E3 was in Atlanta, doesn't have a really big gaming show.
Right.
And once we grew big enough that we felt that we could maintain, if not keep building the first one, it only made logical sense to, well, let's bring one to the East Coast. I don't expect it to be as big as the one this year, but, you know, I I wouldn't be surprised if it exceeded our expectations. Like,
well, this will be the
PAX
first
Prime
year.
Always does. This will be the first year.
So it's in March, right, in Boston?
March 26th through 28th, Boston, the Heinz Convention Center. We chose the center because we know that it's got lots of room to expand, so we're already planning and realizing that more and more people will want to come. It's pretty centrally located. I'm really looking forward to it. I have actually never personally been to Boston, and I have always wanted to, so I'm pretty excited to head out there. I haven't been on one of the fact-finding trips that some of the other guys have been able to go on yet, but I'm sure I'll get my fill when I'm stuck in dark rooms in the convention center setting up boxes and shelving units trying to get ready for the show.
Maybe we'll see you there. We are floating the idea right now of maybe doing a Radio Free Nintendo panel at either PAX East or next year's PAX Prime, I guess, in Seattle.
Well, if you go to the website paxsite.com,
nice.
Yeah, you like that? I had to make sure to enunciate it clearly. There's a button for panel or speaker submissions. It's not open right now, but if you click on it now, you can sign up to be notified when we do open up for the submissions. And then you can put in, that's how we get a lot of our panels. There's some mainstays that we carry over from year to year, or, you know, we'll through all the submissions, we'll see maybe a particular subject matter is a little thin, but people are really good about submitting really unusual and fun panels, and that's one way to do it, is if you got a group or you're on a dev team or you just happen to know a lot of people that are experts in a subject that you think would appeal to the PAX audience, you know, throw your submission down there.
Well, I don't think there are probably a whole lot of Nintendo-centric panels. There definitely aren't very many Nintendo-centric podcasts, so we're hoping that we might have a little bit of a niche for that.
Did any of you guys get a chance to go visit this year? I know, Johnny, you did not.
No.
Nope.
Nintendo had a really good presence this year. They actually set up this fun kiosk out. So they had their booth in the Expo, but they had a separate kiosk out where they were showing Flipbook.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, cool.
They hired a bunch of local artists to sit there for an hour and do Flipbook animations. And you know, talk to people and do these movies and stuff. It was really a cool way to see how that application worked. So yeah, just throwing that out there. Now, I guess even though I don't work for them anymore, I'm still pimping them.
We did send staff though, didn't we?
No, Chuck never made it up there. His ride bailed. So.
Oh, that's too bad. Mm-hmm.
Awesome. What kind of outfit sucks. Are you guys running?
a very sketchy one.
The hamster died in the wheel, so the car wouldn't go up there?
No, he said, I think his exact words were, yeah, my ride bailed and went to France. So there you go. And I was like, okay then. All right, we'll just move on.
Nice. So the solution is PAX France, and then we'll be covered,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's the life of being a volunteer games rider.
Yeah. Your rides just go crazy to shit. Europe randomly, I guess.
Yeah. And you have to ration out your events and things like that. It's like, you know, I can barely afford to go to E3, both in terms of money and time. So mm-hmm. doing PAX as well, it's really tough. I mean, it's tempting, but it's really hard to do.
In a world where there was, you know, I guess E3 was still a big show when PAX was originally conceived. What was the vision for what PAX should be?
It's the con that you want to go to. It's a festival. It's the festival you always wanted to attend. Its genesis was when Mike and Jerry, aka Gabe and Tycho, would get, you know, hey, come to this con. And they'd go to this con and they'd see, well, that's cool, but that's really stupid. Or this element's fun, but why is this here? This doesn't make sense. So they came back and said, you know what we should do is just make the con we want to go to, include all of the fun stuff that we would want to see done. And apparently there's a lot of other people that have the same thoughts and think the same way because they show up at the show. I mean, really, it's the only show that's got this huge video game expo hall, but you want to tap some land over in the tabletop card game area, go ahead. It's
Johnny's gone for weeks now.
No problem.
He's sold. He's already gone. He's buying his tickets as we speak.
So, yeah, I mean, you can throw down and do some D&D or a lot of people, what I think is really cool, a lot of aspiring tabletop game designers come and just in the tabletop free play area bring their game. And you can try out all sorts of cool games, or you can get a marathon session of Munchkin or whatever you want. Or go to Console Free Play and find people to play Rock Band with, or, you know, we have a huge library of old games. You want to play Kickle Cubicle? Go right ahead. There's a copy of it, you know.
Oh, you know I do.
You know I do. What if I just stop playing it?
So it's just, you know, and then on top of all that, you got concerts with, you know, that nerd or geek-centered music, and it's not necessarily about video games, but it's music about culture that we appreciate, where you got like Jonathan Colt and Paul and Storm. Just it's a weekend-long party filled with all the things you love to do as a hobby. I was that a little too salesman-y? I can
no,
do that.
No. I'm sure you're sincere.
I am sincere. That's the problem.
I know that you know, you said earlier that PAX East, there's not really anything like it on the East Coast, but really there's not many conventions at all on the East Coast. So there may not be much of a formula to follow here.
Yeah.
What's it been like trying to set this up for the first time out?
I'll let you know after it's over how we did. You know,
Why does it have to be in Boston in March, though? If you're going to do it in March, it should have been in Orlando or
exactly.
something.
Exactly.
Well, you know, the Boston's got all those colleges. So there's a lot of the core demographic already is there. Plus, it's really easy to get to by mass transit, whether it's the train or, you know, everyone's got a quick flight into Boston. So that's the reason. But hopefully we'll be blessed with nice weather and not all be snowed in. That could be fun too. We can all just, you know, again.
We're all stuck in the convention center.
All right. Well, hey, Jeff Callis, thank you so much for doing this. It was awesome.
I'm glad. Great. Hopefully I was a smidgen entertaining. And, you know, if you try to email me and I don't answer, you know that I've been locked up in some evil Nintendo prison deep in the bowels of Kyoto.
It's okay. I don't think they listen to our show.
Yeah, with nothing to eat but natto, so.
Ouch. Ouch. All right, so we're going to wrap this segment up. Once again, thank you, Jeff, very much. And,
no problem.
We'd love to have you back sometime if you ever want to talk about Eternal Darkness or anything else. Or Penny Arcade Adventures Episode 3.
Whatever.
Mm-hmm. I'll put you on my press release list, and we can work all some right. marketing magic.
Awesome. All right. Yeah, get that shit on WiiWare, and we'll do a review. And you know.
There you go.
Welcome back, and welcome back, Greg.
Yes.
It's time for listener mail. Every week, we try to read some of your interesting, fascinating letters and questions, and Greg actually has the very first one.
Let me just shake off that Pacific Northwest accent I was feigning for the last segment. Kevin writes, why not have DS games that connect to the Wii as well to play with? For God's sakes, there's two virtual console pads and the WiiWare and Nunchuck have enough buttons to play DS games, even if it would be slightly wonky. I think a DS multi-cart game with Wii Play would be the best. It could even use the internet to connect to the Wii that way. Even if it's local multiplayer, that will work as well for up to 300 feet, was it? Seems like the DS has a lot it could still do.
Well, what's it called? Echoes of Time?
Yeah, mm-hmm. For the Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles game, it does exactly that.
The dual version. I haven't Square Enix talked about the fact they've just got a sort of process now for just directly translating DS games to Wii very quickly.
Awesome. We'll get more mediocre games on your Wii.
That's
thanks,
awesome.
Square.
And more direct DS to Wii ports. That's going to be awesome. I can't wait.
Is Kevin talking about kind of the Wii acting as another DS to play like single card games on the DS as well?
So there's a couple different concepts in here. First, I think he's proposing that you be able to use the DS as a Wii controller, which you can do in Pokemon Battle Coliseum or whatever it's called.
Yeah, but I mean that's interacting with your Pokemon game while it's already.
But
in
you
there.
Can use the the DS as a controller for that game. You don't have to pick up a Wii remote once it's on. So there are a couple examples of that, but obviously it's programmed on a game by game basis, and for a lot of games it doesn't make sense because the DS is not a Wii remote. It's not even really a classic controller. It doesn't have joysticks. It doesn't have as many buttons. So there's questionable value in doing that, although, you know, it's not certainly not impossible.
I mean, you could play, like, NES and SNES games on there, which I almost thought at one point that with the DSi they might do a virtual console for those systems on the DSi.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I still think it's very much possible.
And if they do that, I could see them allowing it to be transferred from your Wii.
Mm-hmm. That would be really cool.
And then I would see them being able... or
you mean, like, remote play style?
Well, remote play, though, is sort of streaming. Yeah. You're talking about, like, the PS3, PSP connection. That's kind of streaming. I mean, you can play... there's certain PS3 games you can play on your PSP because it's streaming video. It's, like, on live.
I was thinking more like the demo stuff that you have on there, where it's put into the memory of the...
Right.
Because it's got, you know, 256 in flash memory that it could store it
well,
into.
And then also, yeah, I mean, with the DSi, you have the flash memory, and you also have more RAM.
And you've
RAM.
Got the RAM, yeah.
So you could really store more, and some of it could even be stored semi-permanently, you know, without having to put the DS in sleep mode. Or
yeah, like, they could store, like, the status saves on there, so you could bring it back to your Wii, and it would sync it back up.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be cool. Which means Nintendo will never do it.
Well, exactly. I mean, because the curious thing is that, you know, in general, they have been so hands-off about linking the two together than you would have thought. You know, I mean, it's...
Surprisingly.
I mean, obviously, we've got what Square Enix has done, but, I mean, you
Square
haven't
Enix
had...
Square Enix loves this shit. I mean, honestly.
You have not had a, you know, Four Swords follow-up, you know, the way you are having... You know, you've had a Crystal Chronicles kind of follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
So it just doesn't seem like Nintendo's quite... So, I mean, I guess the implication is that what was going on with the GameCube was just, you know, the sort of very desperate attempt to, you know, sort of create synergy between the two because the Game Boy Advance was so much more popular than the GameCube, whereas both the Wii and the DS are very popular, so they're apparently not quite so motivated to have to create synergy between them.
They talked about, you know, the ability to link the GameCube and the GBA well before the GameCube came out.
They did. Yeah. It is true. But in terms of how far down that road you end up going in terms of resources, it seems like they have to be pushed to do it. And they're not really being pushed because both formats are doing so well as it is. I mean, there are examples, but again, it's fairly trivial, like the Tomodachi collection, the weird Mii's sort of Sims game that came out a while ago in Japan. That's been a pretty big success. You know, you connect to the Wii to sort of download your Mii's off there, and then you insert them into that DS game. So I mean, that's something. But, I mean, this sort of stuff, I mean, what's been talked about in the email seems like, yeah, this kind of thing that's in Crystal Chronicles.
Yeah.
But also, like I said, it kind of sounds like using the Wii almost like as a, you know, the Game Boy player, like kind of like a DS player functionality where you could sort of, you double up using that, and that could therefore help you, like, have a multiplayer without having a second DS or something.
That will never happen.
No,
I don't think that's
going to
happen.
There's too much controller barrier there.
Because the touch functionality obviously
is
always
kind of
there for a lot of games. Obviously, there's plenty of games that don't need that, but
you'd have to support all your games or none of your games, basically.
Exactly, as a standard, it just doesn't seem very establishable.
So, is everybody done talking about this before I go drop some random facts?
Drop your factoid, homie.
All right, so there are four systems that have a sync up to a handheld. Who here can name all four of them and what the handheld was?
One would be the Dreamcast.
What's the handheld?
The VMU.
Wrong.
Was that WonderSwan or something?
It was the WonderSwan, yes.
The WonderSwan. Yeah.
You could sync up your WonderSwan to your Dreamcast.
Jesus.
Yes.
Are you counting PS Mini or whatever
that thing
was called?
I mean, PS3, obviously, and PSP.
And Wii and GameCube and Dreamcast.
I didn't expect anybody here to get the Dreamcast one. I'm duly impressed.
You could thank Retronauts for that.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I mean, they know what they're talking about, because when they did a TurboGrafx episode recently, they finished it with the Lords of Thunder soundtrack. So
yes!
They know what they're talking about.
That's it.
Usually.
Well, it's funny, because I remember back in middle school, I was like super fucking knowledgeable about this shit, and I was like, oh, you have a... Some guy on the bus is like, oh, you have a WonderSwan. You're 1 in 100 people who own handheld systems. Yeah. Congratulations.
Jesus.
What are you playing, Final Fantasy 2 or Final Fantasy 3?
Wait, you had a WonderSwan?
I didn't, but one of my friends did.
That's
I'm
nutty.
They never even sold those in America.
They didn't?
No. He would have had to import that. It never came out in America.
Okay, I'm like, well,
that shit was
do
never
you own
America.
A Dreamcast? You can hook it up to that and do nothing. Congratulations.
That's bizarre. Like, that's weird. That's just
but
weird.
I got
to,
handle a WonderSwan. I'm like, this thing's fucking bizarre looking.
Yeah.
It's like a square with, like, crazy colors on it.
So, it had pretty... The big thing with the WonderSwan in Japan was that it had good support from Square before the whole Square being allowed to work on GBA thing got resolved.
Yeah. And then it was, see you later!
Yeah, exactly.
The rug was pulled, and that was that.
We need to move on.
Random ass knowledge. Taste it.
We need to move on here, and
I don't want to taste anything from you, James. But All right. Brian writes, despite what some of you guys think of on-rail shooters, I am looking forward to both of the major rail shooters coming to Wii this holiday season, Resident Evil Darkseid Chronicles and Dead Space Extraction. The thing is, I'm a broke college student, aren't we all, and will probably only be able to get one of them. I was wondering which of the two similarly conceptual games is more worthy of a purchase in your eyes.
From what we've seen, I'd say Dead Space is a pretty easy choice, unless you're a huge Resident Evil fan.
Did you play both of them at E3, Johnny?
Of the demos, I only played Extraction. I have played Umbrella Chronicles, the retail version.
Yeah, because I remember Zach walked away from Darkseid Chronicles, and I guess he's a big Umbrella Chronicles fan. Less impressed with that than he was with Umbrella.
Yeah.
I walked away from it, you know, I'd never played Umbrella Chronicles before. I thought it was okay. It wasn't great. And then I walked away from Dead Space thinking they just picked a bad demo. So I'd probably go with Dead Space too.
The reviews are starting to come in for Dead Space, of course, whereas Resident Evil is still some time off because it's like mid-November or whatever that's coming out. So at the moment, you've got more to go on with Dead Space, and it looks, the signs are good. And conceptually, some of the things in it just sound a little more interesting, like some of the stuff like the secondary functions of the guns.
Your tractor beam hands.
Yeah, I think with Dead Space, it would probably try a bit harder.
Yeah.
The thing with Resident Evil is they could just trade off the IP. They can it's like your fan service stuff, the 2 or 3 Resident Evil 2, the Code Veronica. And so if you're a big Resident Evil fan, if that, if the canon and the franchise kind of, is something that you like to get back into, then that's obviously something that just Dead Space cannot really explore unless you're also a big Dead Space fan.
Mm-hmm. And you always have the option of waiting and seeing what the same reviewers compare the two games.
But if you're willing to wait, but whereas Dead Space is like out now, and you're going to have to wait, 6 weeks for Resident Evil? Like
that. Yeah, I think, I wasn't really impressed by the Dead Space demo at E3. I think it may just be one of those games that doesn't demo well because of what it is. Yeah. But I'm far more curious about Dead Space Extraction. And it does seem to be the more ambitious game. And that's part of why I'm a little bit anxious to see how it turns out, because, with all the story stuff, which James made quite a bit of fun of, it does have the potential to be a bit over the top, a bit overdone, with the narration. And
yeah.
I mean, maybe some people will like that. I think being that it's that you can't even control the camera, watching people talk for 5 minutes is not that great.
No.
And, we're hearing that there's actually like a lot more story in Extraction than there was in the original Dead Space.
Yeah, it's kind of take it or leave it in the original Dead Space. It's, it's kind of happening while you're playing and to some extent, and it doesn't really interrupt the flow of the game all that much. So I like that. I'm very much more than what I imagine something like Metal Gear Solid is like. So if Dead Space Extraction is more like, it's time to punctuate the action with a dialogue scene, it's I don't really like the sound of that too much.
I don't either.
I would say that Dead Space Extraction feels it's more leveraged on telling a story, whereas Resident Evil feels more leveraged on reminding you of things you saw in another story.
Yeah, like locales and stuff like that. Like,
but I mean, Dead Space Extraction is doing some of that too. I mean, it's
yeah, of course. If you know Dead Space, exactly. It's filling in bits of the story, right? Know before.
Okay, well, the next letter is from Tom, who writes, "My shout-out is for LEGO Star Wars The Complete Saga for Wii. It's important to know that this game is a combination of two previous releases, which were LEGO Star Wars The Video Game and LEGO Star Wars 2 The Original Trilogy. I should also note that there has been some content added from the original games, but not that much. However, if this is your first experience with LEGO Star Wars, you won't be disappointed. There is a ton to do in this game. It's great for the completists out there, but if you don't care about collecting, you can also move quickly through the game and ignore all the additional challenges. Of course, LEGO delivers the entire Star Wars story in its typical comedic fashion, which adds to the enjoyment. With all of that said, Part of the fun is just participating in your favorite scenes from Star Wars with your favorite characters and vehicles. Now, the not-so-great part. As far as motion controls, don't get excited about wielding a lightsaber. You can wave the Wii remote, and the character will swing his or her lightsaber, but that's about it. I would recommend just sticking with the buttons on the Wii remote and nunchuck. Those are my thoughts. $19.99 is well worth the Star Wars-filled 50-plus hours you'll get out of this game.
Wow.
You know, it's kind of... I'd be kind of burned if I bought both the two previous games and they combined them into one single title.
Like Metroid Prime Trilogy?
Yes, exactly.
Did you feel burned by that?
Not really, because
I suppose, well, there's a greater passage of time involved.
Yeah, exactly.
And obviously the controller functionality and the widescreen stuff is...
This is literally like one big middle finger. Like, yep, you bought those games.
Hey, look, you know, for one thing, Wii discs can hold more data than GameCube.
Yeah,
I understand that. But they did this on the other systems too, didn't they?
Probably.
The fact is, if you haven't played them before, it does sound like pretty good values. And if you haven't played any of the LEGO games before, because they are apparently all quite similar, it's kind of what skin you put.
Yeah, they
put
are.
On
they
it,
are so. Literally the same game.
So I guess if you played LEGO Indiana Jones or whatever, going back to this, you'd have to really love Star Wars, I guess, to go back to it. Because
I gotta say, from the little bit of LEGO Star Wars that I've played, I cannot imagine spending 50 plus hours on it. I'm sure there is that much content in there, but
it's
a lot of LEGO.
According to John Davison about his kids, you can play this game for that long, but
that's truly frightening. That makes me not want to have kids.
Oh damn!
You heard it here first.
LEGO Star Wars depopulates the earth.
Yeah, slowly but surely.
They should bring this shit to China.
Good lord.
Oh, Johnny.
Yeah. Okay, well, there's your shout
nothing
out.
After dissing the entire country of China, I really have nothing.
I didn't
just read the next letter.
They have population control
they do,
laws.
They do exercise birth control already. Yeah. Johnny's just recommending a more effective way of doing it.
Somewhere between taxes for additional kids and forced sterility is
LEGO
Star
Wars.
I don't know which is worse.
Fortress, that's what it should be like.
Fortress is awesome. Oh, Christopher Lambert, that voice. Sounds like he's from another dimension.
No, there's nothing better than the sound of Lambert swearing. If you see the start of with the first Highlander, when he's getting interrogated by the cops and he starts swearing up a storm, brilliant.
That's one of my all-time favorite 80s movie moments.
So, James... You have the last question.
I do have the last comment, I guess. It'd be a better word for it.
Yeah.
Freestar writes, "First and foremost, I would like to thank you guys for suggesting Retro Game Challenge. I just got it yesterday, and I'm going through the Rally King as I write this."
Greg, are you still playing Retro Game Challenge?
Yeah, very sparsely. I'm probably going to go back to it more earnestly now that the Web of Shadows is done.
I was really hoping you were going to say, "No, drop it, Mets."
No, I really like that. Although I kind of got bogged down in the Guardia Quest part, and then ended up getting Spider-Man. Yeah, well, you know, because I'm rubbish at that sort of game, and so I've been grinding a lot to kind of, you know, get through. Because you have to beat like a boss in a dungeon to pass the final challenge, which is actually one of the more significant challenges in the game.
Yeah. Learn what the spells do and, you know, get used to them, because there's some pretty powerful spells, and in true old school fashion, it doesn't actually tell you what any of them do, so you just have to experiment.
Exactly, yeah, that's the thing.
But some of them can make a huge difference in boss battles. Okay, anyway, sorry, James, you can finish reading the letter now.
Yeah, so now for my hidden game gem, iNinja for the GameCube. iNinja is a hack and slash where you play as a ninja with a giant head fighting the ranks. But by the way, if people who haven't played this game, the ninja's name is actually Ninja. That was an aside that I have as personal knowledge of this game.
So iNinja is kind of like robot?
Yeah, a little bit. except in this game, the robot would be named Robot. the story is that you find this magic rage power that accidentally kills his master. Now he must find all of the ninja power so he can beat the ranks leader O-Door.
Odor.
Oh, yes. Dear.
Now, this game was a Namco-published title. And I think it was made by Argonaut?
I believe that's correct. I seem to recall that Ty Sugar was a big fan of this game.
Well, that doesn't say anything.
I'm staying far away from it.
I remember that they advertised it heavily in the box for, what was it, Soul Calibur 2. It had two slick inserts in my particular copy of Soul Calibur 2 for iNinja, which is amazing.
Argonaut, yes, and it is Argonaut. Argonaut has made, they've been all over the place.
I think the last game Argonaut released was Malice,
yes.
For Xbox, which was supposed to be a launch title and came out like 3 years after.
On the PS2 and the Xbox, mind you. It's supposed to be like, this is the Xbox game.
Right.
Yes. They also, in that same year, released Power Drome for the Xbox and the PS2 and Catwoman the game.
Oh.
Well-regarded.
Yep. Which, by the way, any review you read of Catwoman the game will be the best review you've ever read.
The thing is, it's amazing, too, because it's based on a great movie. How'd it go wrong? I don't know.
Well, iNinja, I was kind of curious to play it because I think it has a grappling hook. You guys know who I am.
Yeah, I know. I've played Bionic Commando with you sitting on the floor at E3, Johnny.
That's right.
If it had an unlimited jetpack as well, what would you do at that point?
Whoa. Choices, decisions.
He would grapple and then use his jetpack to pull himself up.
Yep.
I will say,
in Shadow Complex, it's not unlimited, but you do have a jetpack and a grappling hook that you can use in tandem, which is pretty awesome. I mean, if it was unlimited, you wouldn't really need a grappling hook.
No, you wouldn't.
But yeah, that combination is kind of, it hits me in a happy place, you know?
His pants.
Yeah, iNinja. That's an interesting shout out, actually.
From what I've played of it, there's quite a few weapons that you can get in the game, like different types of throwing stars and stuff. It's an above average effort. At least in my personal opinion.
Well, that's saying a lot given the other Argonaut games that we were just listing off. So.
fun fact about this game is that Sony actually bought the exclusive publishing rights out from under Namco in Europe, so it only came out on the PS2 in Europe.
Oh, smart business.
Yeah.
That is weird. Like, I can kind of understand them buying the timed exclusive on Ghostbusters for Europe, but iNinja, really?
I think Namco had a really good negotiator at that time.
Yeah, it was part of the deal to get, what it was, Soul Calibur 3.
Throw in a few magic beans with the deal, just to see it.
Oh, man. Okay, that's the last letter of the week. Of course, if you want your letter to be read on the air, if you want us to make fun of you or answer your burning questions, you can send those to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And thanks to everybody who's been doing that, by the way. Also, of course, we're not done talking about Geist. We're going to have another segment next week, and we'd like to have more of the listener and the reader feedback on that. So be sure to hit up the forum thread if you're playing along, or if you've ever played Geist before. Leave some thoughts, ask some questions,
or if
get
you
into
are
discussion.
A disembodied ghost, you can also go ahead and type that in there.
Yep. You can come possess me and play it on my Wii for a while.
You can possess my keyboard and type up your comments. It'll be good.
And before we go, I do want to ask, as I do every now and then, that if you have iTunes, please go and look us up on the iTunes store and give us a little star rating and maybe even write a review if you have a minute. That helps us a lot to reach new listeners because it affects the search results, rankings, and stuff like that. And we've been moving up. It's been really good. We're getting some new listeners from that, so it really does help, and I'd appreciate it if you do that. So that's going to be all for this week. We'll be back next time. So long.
Later.
Bye-bye.
Wouldn't it make more sense to, like, do a 6-axis 2 or a DualShock 4 or
whatever?
So
would it be a DualShock 3 6-axis 2? It's like Super Mario Advance 3?
Well, I mean, couldn't they put some kind of, light-up ball or something on the end of the real controller, and let you use that rather than have this two-hand... I guess they want it two-handed, because then it's more like the Wii.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly it. It goes back to what Nintendo originally said about the Wii Remote, which is, it looks like a remote. It's something people are used to handling.
People aren't used to waving an ice cream cone around in the air.
No, that's true. Well, actually, I am, but that's completely unrelated.
Take your medicine.
And that is an adult conversation.
Okay, weird. You know, I have never made it all the way through Highlander. I tried, and it didn't grab me. I got
the bit where it has a flashback to him in during the Nazi occupation, and he just shoots the shit out of some Nazis and says, "Hey, hey, you're the master race." That's one of the weirder quips in film history, I would have to say.
I like to think the end of Radio Free Nintendo is like sneaking out of a girl's room after sunrise.